This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Coming today, we are scheduled to be joined by former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, also the former head of the National Democratic Party. He'll comment on the state of the Democratic Party in the South and his appearance at the True Blue Gala for Louisiana Democrats next week here in Baton Rouge. Also, Malcolm Suber of Take 'em Down NOLA on his quest to have more monuments removed in New Orleans. Malcolm Suber believes the iconic statue of Andrew Jackson should be taken down in Jackson Square. And Baton Rouge gardening legend Walter Imahara on his profession and his days as a young man in a Japanese internment camp in Arkansas. He was 5 years old when his family was forced to move from California to Arkansas. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana on WRKF, and our guest to begin the show today is former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, also the former head of the National Democratic Party. And Governor McAuliffe will be in Baton Rouge next week on the 18th for the 2018 True Blue Gala. He is the keynoter. We'll have more information about this event, but it is a pleasure to talk with you, Governor Terry McAuliffe.
Jim, it's an honor to be with you, and I'm looking forward to heading down to Louisiana.
Well, you know the South pretty well. You were, of course, very good friends with the former president, and right now the South is not a fertile ground for many Democrats. It's changed a great deal over the course of our lifetime. What do you think the future is for the Democratic Party in the South?
Well, I think it's very bright. Let's just take Virginia, where I just finished being governor. Got elected governor, I had taken over the state. Republicans controlled all the statewide offices. We only had 33 Democrats in our House of Delegates. When I left office 4 years later, we swept all the statewide offices. Democrats control them all, and we picked up 15 House of Delegates seats, the most we've had since 1880. So Virginia, which was a blue state, now we've made it a little bit bluer. It used to be ruby red. And the reason is, I think, Jim, is that under our 4 years as governorship, $20 billion of new capital projects, 200,000 new jobs. Our economy, our employment went from 5.4 all the way to 3.6. Get in, empower people, give them an opportunity, give them a great job, fix your education system, and people will reward you. And that's what's going to happen to Democrats across the South. So what was a red state is now a blue state. We did it in Virginia. John Bell is making great progress in Louisiana. So, you know, I think the future is bright. If we have candidates who focus on economic empowerment, building a great infrastructure economically, creating thousands and thousands of new jobs, that's what voters want. I don't care what your political party is. They want politicians who are going to get in and focus on the things that matter to them.
We're visiting with Governor Terry McAuliffe. He'll be in Baton Rouge next week, the 18th, for the True Blue Gala. That's a week from tomorrow night. It'll be at the Crown Plaza, and we'll have information on how you can be there if you so choose. Certainly, Governor McAuliffe is well-known throughout the country, having been head of the Democratic National Committee as well. Now Governor McAuliffe, we don't have many Southern governors. Governor John Bel Edwards is one of the few who are Democrats.
He and Roy Cooper in North Carolina and Ralph Northam in Virginia now.
That's it. So the southernmost Democratic governor is our governor in Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, who is facing a very tough reelection quest, probably against U.S. Senator John Kennedy, who was with us yesterday. Mm-hmm. Symbolically, how much does it mean for the Democratic Party to have John Bel Edwards win reelection?
Well, very important. In fact, when I was governor of Virginia for a while, I was the only Southern governor. And then, of course, John Bell won, and then Roy Cooper won in North Carolina. But keep showing what we can do in the South. But you know, John Bell, I believe, is the most popular Democratic governor in the country today, if you look at his poll numbers. And the reason is, you know, John, just like I did when I became governor, I inherited a fiscal mess from the Republican administration before me. I inherited a $2.4 billion deficit, which we fixed, and I left office, which will be the largest surplus in the history of the state. John Bell inherited a horrible economy with a fiscal cliff, and he's worked very hard. It's gotten better. We still obviously have economic issues we have to deal with in Louisiana, but great progress has been made in the work he's done to boost the Louisiana economy. And I think people will reward John Bell for that. In addition, you got Medicaid expansion done, which, you know, came in April of 2018, which created about 19,000 new jobs and brought literally billions of dollars back to the state. He's done great work on flood relief, getting money from the federal government, and he's got an infrastructure plan. So very similar to what I did as governor of Virginia, focused on the economy, working on infrastructure, and I think people go reward John Bell for that work. I mean, people are sick and tired of the partisan bickering. I've never seen the country so divided. What they want are leaders like John Bell, steps up, addresses the issue, and gets things done. But it is, to answer your question, Jim, very important that we keep that governorship in Louisiana.
Terry McAuliffe will be at the Crown Plaza, 7 p.m. next Friday. You can go to LouisianaDemocrats.org for more information if you'd like to attend, or call the Democratic Party office here, 336-4155, 225-336-4155. But Democrats, LouisianaDemocrats.org is where you'll find all the information about this event with Governor Terry McAuliffe. Now, John Bel Edwards is having some challenges working with a Republican legislature, philosophical challenges and political challenges. You had similar obstacles.
Yep.
How did you navigate that process?
Well, as I mentioned, Virginia was hit very hard due to sequestration. Virginia is the number one recipient of Department of Defense dollars, and we really got whacked for about 5 years with our economy. And the budgeting process got off kilter, and I'd say it resulted in a huge deficit. So when I came into office, I told my Republicans, we're going to put politics aside. We're going to do what voters want us to do, and we're going to get things done. And if you're not going to support me on these issues, well, I'll be glad to hold a press conference tomorrow and say you're inhibiting our ability to grow jobs in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And as it related to economic development, my legislature, as I say, I had 33 out of 100. I got everything I wanted on economic development. I got $1 billion for education, the largest investment in Virginia history in K-12. We've got a record $10 billion I put out on transportation. So the legislature worked. I went with a plan. We worked together. Now, I will tell you, on social issues, we disagreed vehemently. I also have the record for the most vetoes of any governor in Virginia history, 120. But the point I always try to make, and it was very bad, anti-environment, anti-women, anti-LGBT, anti-voting, and those issues, you cannot recruit the businesses of the 21st century, the Amazon, the Google, the Facebook, the Microsoft, the Salesforce. Jim, they will not come to a state that has discriminatory laws. So I had to veto those bills, and I convinced my legislature not to offer them anymore. And the result, as I say, we brought a record $20 billion from Apple, from Amazon, from Google, billions of dollars they invested in Virginia. And that was $7 billion more than any governor in the history of our state. And they realized that they've got to stay out of these social issues if they want to grow and create jobs for their children. And when I say jobs, I talk about good, high-paying jobs. Virginia is now, after I left office, the number one state in America for cybersecurity. The number one state in America for data analytic companies. Number one state in America for unmanned systems. To the point that we now, as I say, I got unemployment all the way down to 3.6 when I left office. I have 38,000 cyber jobs open in Virginia today. Starting pay is $88,000.
All right, so you're making the case that you can work with a Republican legislature. The governor's in the middle of a session right now and having some challenges. And I think part of it is philosophical, part of it's political, but that's the nature of politics, which you know pretty well.
Yep.
How much of a factor, perhaps to a positive degree, is President Trump to the Democratic Party right now? Is he a gift that keeps on giving?
Well, he is. I can tell you, in our election last year, you know, we go right after the presidential election. As I say, we picked up the most seats since 1880. We swept all of our statewide, the biggest turnout we've ever had. And then, of course, you know, we've got our new Alabama senator. We've got our new congressman from Pennsylvania. What I think has happened is first and foremost, 92 million people did not vote in the 2016 presidential election, Jim. And I think they woke up the next day and said, holy cow. So I think people are realizing, you better get out, you better vote. As I always say, people have fought and died for the right to vote in this country. I have a son who's a Marine today, just got back from Iraq. People are putting their lives on the line for the freedoms and opportunities we have in this great country. And the least you can do is go out and vote. So I think you're going to see voter turnout very large this year, which is going to be very good. I think we're going to win the United States House of Representatives. I think we're going to win a slew of governors this year. But listen, I was the chairman of the governors, the national governors. I told President Trump, I'm willing to work with you. We will work together on infrastructure, on health care, and on the economy. But unfortunately, what they've done in health care, rolling back the individual mandate and the cost-sharing subsidies, Jim, that is sending premiums up all over the country. The infrastructure bill they passed, they're meaningless. It's worthless. You know, we have to put up $4 for every dollar that the feds put up. That's just not going to turbocharge infrastructure. So I believe people are upset that, you know, he's not delivering on the things that he said he would do, and he's actually hurting good safety net, like health care. He's not helping on education. So I think that's going to come in this November election, and people want to get back where people are actually working together, solving problems, and standing for those progressive values as a Democrat that I believe in, give everybody opportunity, and making sure your state is open and welcoming to everyone.
Well, Governor McCallum, we thank you for your time today. We look forward to your appearance a week from tomorrow, Friday night, 7 o'clock, Crown Plaza. And as mentioned, 225-336-4155 or LouisianaDemocrats.org. You can find out more information about attending this event if you so choose. It's been a pleasure. Terry McAuliffe.
Thank you, Jim. See you next week.
This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing. If you'd like to join us, 877-217-5757 or 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. Please send us an email if you'd like to talk@talklouisiana.org. And note that thousands of Louisiana seniors and people with disabilities have begun receiving notices that they could soon be forced out of facilities because of the state's budget crisis, and Governor John Bel Edwards and House Republicans are getting lots of attention, both locally and nationally, and we will discuss this at length tomorrow, and an issue over the last few years that perhaps has gained more attention than any other. Some would say needlessly so, but nonetheless, the issue has been significant, is the monuments issue in New Orleans, in which Mayor Mitch Landrieu took down four statues that had been around for many years, lionizing Confederate icons. And the person who led the opposition for many years is still doing so, Malcolm Suber. He's with us with Take 'em Down NOLA. And he is calling for the new mayor, Latoya Cantrell, who took office Monday, to, in his judgment, stop having, quote, secret meetings with Confederate monument supporters. Good morning, Malcolm Suber.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine. What about these, quote, secret meetings? What's going on? What do you know about this?
Well, you know, we discovered it like everybody else in the newspaper. There was an article in The Advocate that there had been meetings going on between the Cantrell administration and the Frank Stewart and the Monumental Task Force. And those people are distinguished, of course, because they are the main proponents of maintaining the white supremacist statues. So definitely we were disturbed that such a meeting would take place, and moreover that it would take place without public notice and about a subject to which we have very much interest.
Well, you are calling not only for the monuments that have been removed to stay removed, but also, Malcolm Suber of Take 'em Down NOLA, you want other monuments to be removed from the New Orleans landscape. Yeah. Where do you start? Who goes down first if this mission becomes successful?
Well, our position is that they all must go. Every last one of them. There are 17 monuments. There's 30 to 40 schools that remain named for Confederates or white supremacists. And there are hundreds of street names and park names.
Well, the one that has gained the most attention, as you know, you fully well know what you're doing. You're a bright man, and you've been successful in this endeavor. You're going after the big guy, the big guy.
Yes.
The seventh president of the United States.
Right.
Why Andrew Jackson?
Well, of course, Andrew Jackson was notorious as being the architect of the Trail of Tears, as well as being a big slave owner and slave trader. And so we don't think that anybody of that ilk should be given any prominent position in our city, no matter what people say about his role in the defense of the city of New Orleans in the War of 1812. As they say, you know, his bad deeds erased all his good deeds.
Well, he is considered to be the hero of the Battle of New Orleans. His statue is also, by the way, the one that is outside the White House in Washington.
I understand that. I understand that as well as that's on the, that Donald Trump has a replica of the statue on his windowsill in the Oval Office.
He's taken a shine to Andrew Jackson, who was a fighting man, and as we know, Donald Trump was not, but Andrew Jackson, he got in the middle of duels and wars, and he was the real deal when it came to fighting and putting his own butt on the line. And some say that he fought for America. That's a little different than these people, the Confederates, who fought against the government of the United States. Do you make a distinction at all?
Well, we make a distinction in terms of white supremacy and Confederates. They are all of the same cloth. And that's the reason that we want to take down Andrew Jackson.
When I was a kid, and you're probably old enough to remember this too, remember there was an Andrew Jackson Steakhouse on Royal Street across from the Monte Leone? His name was all over the place. And we never thought about Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, being an evil force. And some would say, look, you could get some more of these Confederate. There's still some Confederate statues out there. Why start with somebody who's going to be a polarizing figure, to say the least, when you could go after some of these lower-level Confederates and might have success?
Well, the polarization already exists, and that's why we were so critical of the mayor. There was an open, heated debate couple of years ago. The city council came to the conclusion that the arguments made by the proponents of the white supremacy monuments made no sense and were indefensible, and that these things were offensive to the people of New Orleans and should be removed. We're just saying that all of them should be removed, not just four. And, of course, that's why we are so critical of former Mayor Landrieu, that he basically did not understand that if you're going to open up a hornet's nest, let's finish the job. Do it.
You say he didn't go far enough.
Right. If he sincerely believed what he said in his speech of last May 19th, then he would not be satisfied with allowing these things to stay up. Because they represent the same thing. And so to take down four is just like an appetizer, not the whole meal.
An appetizer, not the whole meal, to take down those four statues. David in Atlanta, what do you think?
I draw the line with Confederates who took up arms against the United States of America. And I'd like to give the audience a history regarding Robert E. Lee Boulevard in New Orleans. In 1954, that was Hibernia Parkway. The white racist city fathers of New Orleans renamed Hibernia Parkway to Robert E. Lee Boulevard as a protest to the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education. I'd like to ask your guests, is there a movement to rename Robert E. Lee Boulevard in New Orleans? And I'd like to suggest Antoine Fats Domino Boulevard or Dorothy May Taylor Boulevard.
All right. What do you think of those suggestions?
We are fully in support of those kind of suggestions. But, of course, we always took the position that got to rename Lee Circle, got renamed Jeff Davis, got to rename Robert E. Lee Boulevard. and that we should honor those people who stood up against racism and fought against racism and oppression. So we would support his thing. But the main thing is we think that this has to be a public process, that the people have to be consulted, and this is not something that can be left to the mayor of New Orleans alone.
Well, you have written a letter to LaToya Cantrell, the mayor of New Orleans, saying it is with great dismay that we write this letter on behalf of Take 'Em Down NOLA, which you say is made up of thousands of African-American and progressive people in the city of New Orleans. Malcolm goes on to say, after years of work and untold numbers of other concerned people, four Confederate monuments were finally taken down, placed into storage. The news media has recently reported that you, the mayor, have set up a secret working group to advise you on what to do with the four Confederate monuments. That group includes Frank Stewart, one of the most vocal opponents of taking down the statues, also Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser. Now, Billy Nungesser believes that the statues should be put on plantation grounds outside of New Orleans. What are your thoughts about what should be done with the statues now that they are, quote, in storage, Malcolm?
Well, my position and our position always was that they should be destroyed, that they have no real significance artistically, and that, you know, if we don't destroy them, they will be displayed again by some people who have don't have a sensitivity to our understanding of history. And so that's why this whole thing is being kicked up again right now.
All right, hold tight. We're going to spend a bit more time with Malcolm Suber after we pause. 877-217-5757 is your number. Back after the news. This is Jim Engster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Allie Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. A bit more time with Malcolm Suber of Take 'Em Down NOLA. He is calling on Mayor LaToya Cantrell, who just took office in New Orleans, to, quote, stop holding secret meetings with Confederate monument supporters. And Malcolm believes that there may actually be a move to restore the four monuments that were taken down, and he believes they should be destroyed, completely destroyed. 877-217-5757. Paul in Opelousas, you're on the air with Malcolm Suber. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Jim. Good issue. How you doing, Mr. Subaru? Just a question. Almost every city and parish in the state of Louisiana has some monument or statue or recognition of the Civil War and the slavery and antebellum times. So we're not going to demolish all of them. Would it be a better idea, just thinking, to correctly put what's under the monument and the definition of what the person actually did versus a monument parked somewhere in New Orleans? I'm just putting that out there. That I think the incorrect thing was that, which you've justified, the incorrect thing was that the statement of what the person did wasn't truly justified. Should that be truly stated in those monument places, as for Andrew Jackson and the Trail of Tears and all that good stuff like that?
All right. Thank you, Paul. Malcolm, would that be a palatable compromise?
Well, no. We think that we don't believe in putting badges and explanatory notes. We think that these things should be erased. And, you know, the history books are still the history books. We're not erasing history as people claim. We're just saying that this is public property. The people who are the majority voters in New Orleans now have the home rule right to decide what goes on our public property. And we have decided that we don't want white supremacy monuments, white supremacy names on our schools and public buildings.
All right, John on Essen, you're next. Shane in New Iberia, you're on the air with Malcolm Suber. Hi, Shane.
Hi, and I respect his opinion very much, but as a professional historian, I think that the monuments themselves are history. They're not Civil War history. They're history of white supremacy and racism. So history, I think a lot of people think that history is supposed to be very Disney-esque and pretty and happy all the time, but a lot of history is ugly. That doesn't mean it should be destroyed. I don't believe they should be put up in a place of honor, but they could be put in a state museum. You don't tear down Auschwitz, for example, just because it's ugly and unpleasant. And I think there could be a proper place to put them in context where they're not in a place of honor but could still be preserved.
All right, Shane. Is that a compromise? You have taken such a hard line, Malcolm, that I'm not sure you can budge in your own mind, but what would be the big deal about putting these monuments, which have been taken down, in some museum where people could go and look at them if they wanted to, or stay away if they didn't like them?
I mean, the question is what we as a city of Atchison decide. They've got plenty of statues already existing all over the world, so adding to that treasury just doesn't appeal to us at all.
James in Metairie. Hello, James. Good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Well, good morning to you, Jim, and to Malcolm. I've been a long-term, at least on talk radio, opponent to these filthy enemy monuments. They glorify enemies. They give honor to enemies of the United States of America. As a veteran, 365,000 U.S. troops were killed by Robert E. Lee's people under the guidance of the white supremacist, absolutely disgusting person named Jefferson Davis. I want the monuments removed from the city, from the parish of Orleans, taken somewhere. I do not want them destroyed. That only gives an ammunition to your enemies, Malcolm. You want to? They're going to compare you to Al Qaeda. You know, just take them out of the city, put them somewhere where people outside of the city can see them. And one more thing, as far as taking down the statue of Andrew Jackson, I will fight you, Malcolm, just as hard against that as I am for these statues of Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis.
Why?
Andrew Jackson was a United States president. Andrew Jackson saved the city, saved the country against an enemy, just like General Grant saved the country against an enemy. Andrew Jackson is an American hero. His statue should absolutely remain. Lee and Jefferson Davis were absolutely enemies of the United States of America. They wanted to keep you, Malcolm, in chains. Andrew Jackson may have had slaves or whatever. You know, nobody in this life does everything correctly. He's an American hero. Thank you, Jim.
Okay, thank you, James in Metairie. Malcolm, your response.
Well, I don't consider Andrew Jackson an American hero. And the actual fact is the Battle of New Orleans occurred after the war was over. So that would not have made that much of a difference.
Well, what if the U.S. had lost New Orleans?
But the treaty had already been signed in Europe, calling for the end of the war. So relations between America and Britain were already settled. That was a moot question at that point. But it was a heroic act. That's not no problem. But as I said earlier, the evil that men do cover up the good that they've ever done. And we see this right now in the Me Too movement. We've got all these rich white guys who over the years contributed and been praised. And look at them now.
Okay, 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Malcolm Suber of Take 'em Down Lola, who's trying to get Andrew Jackson and several other statues removed in addition to the four that were taken from the landscape last year. Mike in Sherwood. Mike, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to the caller, a couple of callers ago, who tried to compare the removing of the statues to the tearing down of Auschwitz. That's absolutely crazy. The comparison should be the tearing down of these statues versus the tearing down of Nazi statues and symbols in Germany after World War II. That's the comparison. I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Mike. In Germany, there are no statues, to my knowledge, glorifying Adolf Hitler. So,
can you display his flag.
But some would say comparing Adolf Hitler to Robert E. Lee is not analogous either. How do you respond to degrees of culpability and atrocities of mankind?
Well, I mean, you know, the question is the historical verdict. Basically says that these people fought on the wrong side, fought against the government, fought against progress. And we measure people by the lens that we have now, and measure by the lens that we have now. There is no logical explanation why we should keep these Confederate monuments standing all over this country. There's no excuse.
Well, thank you, Malcolm Suber. Take them down, NOLA, and I suspect this issue will continue, and we'll be calling on you again. Appreciate your time today. We're joined in studio by a fascinating gentleman who has lived a full life, to say the least, Walter Imahara, 80 years young. He is a Baton Rougean, but it came this way by the most unusual of circumstances. His life was profiled to a large degree in The Last Country Roads by one Ed Cullen, who was a guest with us not so long ago. Good morning, Walter.
Yeah, good morning.
Walter, before we get to your best-known, the best-known part of your life as a gardener, you were sent to a Japanese internment camp when you were a very young boy. And you recall that vividly, as I think anybody would, but it's hard to believe that I'm talking to a man who was there, who knew it and felt it. What was it like?
I was there a total of 3.5 years. Of course, I was young. I'm 5 years old. But so for us to be incarcerated into a camp, it was called concentration camp from the very beginning. But after a while, concentration was not used, called internment or relocation camp. And we ended up in Arkansas, of all places, 10 camps built throughout the United States. 122,000 Japanese Americans were put into camp, living on the West Coast, approximately 100 miles inland, because President Roosevelt felt that if Japan attacks California, he needs that 100-mile inland protection.
So you were moved from your family home in California. What city?
My father was living on his own 60-acre grape farm. And you got to remember, in the 1900s, all the anti-Asian laws on the West Coast prevented Americans to buy land. But then there's one law that was passed, and that if you're an American citizen, in fact, you could buy land. You know, even though I think about what the current administration talks about, you know, now and then about the rights of American citizen. So we, as American citizens, take it very seriously. We're good Americans.
Walter Imahara, how long have you lived in Baton Rouge?
I must have been living here since the early 50s, so I've been here a long time.
So about 65 years.
65 years.
Of his 80 years. We'll talk with him about then and now. This man survived a Japanese internment camp and now has become a fixture in this community. 877-217-5757. Back after this timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Another segment with Walter Imahara, a fascinating man who's been in Baton Rouge for about 65 years, but his life began 8 decades ago in the great state of California. His father was a prominent farming person and living on the land and doing a good job of it. And then the United States went to war with Japan, and President Roosevelt, in perhaps the worst move of his presidency, called for the internment of Japanese Americans, and over 100,000 Japanese Americans were sent to camps across the United States. Walter and his family went to McGee, Arkansas, a place that I've been through many times, fine little town, and recently you went back there. for a reunion. What was that like?
There's the two camps. It's called Jerome, and the other camp is Roarer. They're separated by 25 miles. And McGee, Arkansas, is right in the town of McGee is right in the middle. And for 5 years now, they have a reunion at the camp. And for instance, the town has given the at the train station a nice building to make a museum.
What do you recall about those times?
When I'm as a child, it's not as difficult because we had food, we had churches of different denomination, and we played baseball, so we didn't really feel any hardship per se. Because in the evening, you go into your little building, and your parents are there. I think the parents had it the worst.
Yeah. How did it affect your parents?
They had a lot of bad effects from it. My father was bitter, very bitter, after losing his 60-acre farm in California, just overnight just lost it, and put into relocation camp with 8 children. So when he came out, he was very bitter, and he went to New Orleans, of all places. He didn't want to go back to California. He said the prejudice is still high. If he got off the train or bus...
In California,
being paid $25 per person, 8 children, my parents, he had $250 to start with. I think that he said that it was like getting off of a new world. There's nobody to meet him. There's no start. So he went to New Orleans.
And then ultimately ended up in Baton Rouge.
Yes. And the good story is, from New Orleans, he got a job at Afton Villa, Gardens Inn, St. Francisville. And then he came to Baton Rouge, started his own business. But Jim, I think the best story is, of the 9 children of my father, 8 got college education. That's how we did it. And we go by the 3 rules, that education, number 1. Number 2, because of education, you get a job, get a good job. You help everyone else to college. But number 3, very important, the Japanese or the Asians, we live by the rules. So we very rarely ever get in trouble, as I see on television, newspaper every day.
And you ended up, irony of ironies, you became a U.S. military officer.
Yes, I went to Southwestern, my horticulture degree, and I joined the service, and I joined because my father said to all 4 boys, when we graduate, what service are you going to go into? So we knew we had to go to service. I joined the Army, and I went to OCS to get a commission. And in those days, everybody around me was 6-foot Caucasian, but I knew I was going to have a hard time. But because of my previous weightlifting, I had the strength. So all of a sudden, I broke the OCS record. I became an asset.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
I can tell you're still in good shape. Mm-hmm. And you've had an amazing life. And there seems to be no bitterness about what happened to you and your family.
Oh, there's no bitterness. We are very grateful. When we started, my father came here in the 50s, and we opened up the Garden Center in 68. 50 years ago, the people of Baton Rouge have supported us. At the beginning, we thought maybe they wouldn't, but they soon found out we're really American citizen. Okay, and then since then, for the last 50 years, we're just proud to be in Baton Rouge because of the support we got.
Yeah. Well, a few weeks ago, on April 29th, you closed the 54-acre botanical garden. So the last few days, I say a few weeks ago, we're talking 11 days ago, the last few days have been quite interesting for you. I bet you feel naked in some ways without your garden.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a big letdown. But then again, being a Japanese, everything in our life comes into different chapters. Okay, maybe I'm toward the final chapter, and everything I've done in my life and all my activities, when the time came, we cut it off. We go to the next. So we just keep moving on. So I don't think we're going to have a problem with it. But the gardens were very nice because a lot of material was given to me by nurserymen in Louisiana, just donations mm-hmm. after donations, because they knew what I was going to do. And it's the garden's going to always be there. It might not be open to the public, but it's be open to me.
Yeah. Open to you. Well, yeah, I can tell you stayed in great shape. And when I was a young man in Arkansas, a lot of my mm-hmm. relatives were farmers, and they were all in good shape. But the next generation, not in as good a shape, because now they got all these machines doing things for them. And those rippling muscles have been replaced by machines doing the hard work. But as a gardener, what you did, you can't get a machine to replicate it, can you?
No, no. Yeah.
Well, this was something you knew about, I guess, from your days as a very young boy in California, didn't you? This was kind of the family business.
It's a family business, and my father was the pusher. He lived to age 97, okay, and he was a real big thinker. He could think out the box before we knew what the word was. He could look in the future, and he didn't have any bitterness in him after he got rid of it, because he wanted to push his children to education in different fields. What's interesting is there's eight of us got education in Louisiana, and just two of us stayed behind. All my brother and sister, they left for greener grass, which was California.
Well, I've got a few questions from listeners. One from Patricia. How many of your siblings are still around? How many brothers and sisters do you have
left? Oh, we still have about nine.
Is there still a lot?
Correction, seven.
Seven.
Seven out of nine.
And where are you in the birth order?
Well, I'm about the middle. And I have all these five sisters above me.
They're all alive?
No, except one. We lost one, yeah.
But you're 80 years old, so yeah. We're talking about a family that's living well, taking care of itself.
It's hard to say, but we're now in the 70s and 80s. But we do take care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And listener, you said you set a record for weightlifting when you were in the Army?
I set many records in my lifetime in weightlifting, starting from Southwestern and Lafayette. I won the national championship for Southwestern three times. And there never been a national champion at Southwestern. So
What was your specialty?
This is a weightlifting, so we had the press, snatch, and clean and jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And I was weighing about 120 pounds, but I got up to real heavy. I got up to about 132, and I was still breaking all the records, collegiate records. And later on, when I went into the Army, and from 62 to 68, I was six times national champion for the United States. And
so at 132 pounds, how much were you lifting?
I could press 260 pounds.
So double your body weight.
Yeah, yeah. And snatch 250, clean jerk over 300.
Yeah, yeah. I've often said I think it's good if a person, a man in particular, because we do have this thing called testosterone, if we can lift our body weight. You did double your body weight.
Double body weight.
And you served in the Army during the Vietnam era.
No. That was my brother. I was in during the Berlin crisis, okay? And of all places, when I was moved, stationed there in 61 to 63, I was stationed at Camp Dachau. And that's where I seen so much atrocities, and it made our life, what we went through, like nothing. I can remember.
How did that affect you?
Affect me a lot later on, because during that period, we're ready to go to war. I didn't know too much about Dachau. We knew where the ovens were. But now, many years later, I can't talk about it too much. I mean, like over 50,000 people got murdered there, and there's so many, there's no record of it. And when we were in camp, out of the 120,000 people, 10 camps, four persons were killed. See, so you could see the difference. and it impacted my life. It has.
Well, you're an amazing man and still going, and this, I hope, is the first of a few visits with us, Walter Imahara. Thank you, Walter. It's been a pleasure.
And you're
thanks
welcome.
For sharing your story. What a story. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, for Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill. I'm Jim Inkster. Hope you have a great Thursday, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.